by. Wait on the corner.
Let me tell you a story about a boll weevil. Now, some of you may not know, but a boll weevil is an insect, and he's found mostly where cotton grows.
Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
The first thing you're going to discover is that Shelby Singleton is the record producer, not me. But about 20 minutes ago, I thought, well, let's put a few of Shelby's hits on before we introduce them to you. And this is one of those times where it was hard to cull a few. And, I saved my favorite for an intro later, no doubt, which we'll get to. But Shelby Singleton might be, in many ways, the greatest pop record promoter, and country, too, soul, while we're at it, that ever lived. When you hear some of his antics, you won't believe it. But not only a promoter, a producer to the point where one record enabled him to buy Sun Records. Okay, so what do you do with a catalog? After all, since it wasn't really up and functioning, we're going to find out. You'll also find out about SSS and the fact that it might be Shelby who produced one of the first music videos, and a soul one at that, and a great one, which was on display at the Country Music Hall of Fame last year in their Night Train to Nashville exhibit. But we'll find out how you go from promoting to producing, how you buy a record label, and what you do with it. But more to the point, we're also going to find out how you drive RCA crazy. Because Shelby did it single-handedly. Shelby Singleton's about to join us.
Oh boy, it's the Raleigh James Show.
I wanna tell you all a story about a Harper Valley widowed wife who had a teenage daughter who attended Harper Valley Junior High. Well, her daughter came home one afternoon and didn't even stop to play. And she said, Mama, got a note here from the Harper Valley PTA. Well, the note said, Mrs. Johnson, you're wearing your dress is way too high. It's reported you've been drinking and are running around with men and going wild.
Out of her car and on your radio, it's the Empress of the Interstates, Raleigh James.
Girl this way. And it was signed by the Secretary, Harper Valley PTA.
Well, since it enabled him to buy Sun Records, it's a fine place to start, and I got a lot of questions. Shelby Singleton, welcome to the Raleigh James Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm delighted. So the first thing I got to ask is it true that, I think it was right before an award show, you actually cut off Jeannie C. Riley's dress so it would be a mini dress?
Of course.
Tell me that story.
Well, she came out dressed like she was going to some 16 coming out ball or something, and I said, you're not supposed to look that way. So we got the scissors and we trimmed the dress off.
How hard did she yell?
Well, she didn't yell that much.
All right.
And during those days when artists are young and just starting, they'll listen to you.
Well, now that's the next thing, because I've heard a story that Jeannie was a secretary on Music Row, and that the day she was coming into Columbia to cut that, she was just ticked off as all get out, and that anger is what you hear in the song.
That's not exactly true. I think she was more scared than anything else.
Really?
Is I was afraid she wasn't going to show up for the recording session, so I had two other girls standing by to record the song.
Who would they have been?
Oh, let me think. One girl's name was Margaret Lewis, and the other one's name was Becky Bluefield.
We see what happened to their careers.
Yeah, they didn't quite make it as big.
Was that Columbia A or B?
It was Columbia A.
Okay, terrific. And there's another story I've heard that the original demo for this featured your wife, I guess ex-wife at the time, Margie Singleton?
No, that's not true.
It's not true?
Oh, no, there was a lady named Alice Joy.
Okay.
Who had done that.
All right. Terrific. And of course, that record beat everybody's expectations. Did it also beat yours?
Yes, it did.
And it gave you the funds, actually, a year later to buy Sun Records.
That's correct.
And that's pretty unprecedented. And at the time, I guess Sun, though, with Sam Phillips and all, was kind of on its way down. So really what you bought was a catalog of masters?
That's basically it. Sun had been kind of dormant for many years, and I think Sam had got disenchanted with the music industry, and he was more concentrating on his Holiday Inn holdings and his radio stations than he was on Sun.
And, of course, at the time, he had probably the first all-woman radio station on WHER there in Memphis.
Right, and, WHER in Memphis.
Yeah, right, and WLIZ in West Palm, I think he had.
Right.
And so here you come in and buy Sun. Now, his son, Knox, remained a partial owner?
Well, now Sam remained a partial owner until he passed away.
Okay, all right.
Now I think that probably goes to the family, Sam's wife, Becky, and the sons, Jerry and Knox.
But, of course, you were the overwhelming majority stockholder, and to be able to buy a catalog of that much of a legend for, what was it, $1 million?
I've never told anybody what I paid for.
Really? Okay. Because in the trades and stuff, it had always read that it was $1 million. But I did hear that last year you were offered $35 million for it, wanting to have it moved back to Memphis by somebody?
Well, that's, you know, there's always somebody coming in that thinks they want to buy it, but, you know, it's got to be somebody that knows what to do with it.
Absolutely. Unless you get all cash.
There's been several offers, you know, and we would probably sell it for the right price, but, you know, so far nobody's wrote a check.
Yeah, and everything's for sale, of course. But knowing what to do with it, you really knew what to do with it. And, of course, we'll get to your re-releases, but as I mentioned, you are arguably the greatest promoter in pop music history. So I want you to tell me all about Orion.
Well, Orion was a figment of a lot of people's imagination, really.
Yeah.
Orion, I heard about him many years before I ever recorded him, but he was a Elvis sound-alike. He wasn't an impersonator, but his voice was exactly like Elvis's. And what we did with Orion is we recorded songs that Elvis had never recorded before. And we put a mask on him and made the whole world think that Elvis was still alive. And this is where all the stories and all the tabloids and everything got started about Elvis being alive and being spotted here and there and other places. And it was actually a successful promotion all over the world until the idiot pulled the mask off on me.
Yeah, on stage.
Right.
Yeah, at the I guess the crescendo of one of his acts, there goes the mask. But now, to go back, when you first released something on him, I think it was before you called him Orion, there was no name on the label?
That's right. We did Blue Moon of Kentucky and That's All Right Mama and put it out without a name on it.
And so RCA just assumed it must be an old Elvis master, and they
right,
were coming.
Right, until they ran a voice print on it, they just knew it was it was something I had pulled out of the vaults and released, you know.
Yeah, right, and against the $35,000 that they paid for all of Elvis's masters.
Right.
Another one of those unbelievable stories. But all right, so there you go. He's got no name, but clearly he's going to come something. And then I understand Orion was the name of a character in a book.
Well, there was a book called Orion. It was written by a lady named Gail Giorgio down in Atlanta. And what it was almost like a Harold Robbins novel where it was a parallel on really Elvis's life. But the gimmick in the whole book, at the end of the book, he faked his own death and was a pallbearer at his own funeral. So the people that read the book automatically, they thought that Orion was really Elvis and Elvis was still alive.
It couldn't have been better. It just, I mean, even Major Bill Smith wrote a book on this. So.
Oh, I know. Major Bill was quite a character himself.
Yeah, absolutely. But convinced till his dying day that Elvis had been spotted at a Sonic Burger.
Of course.
So, yeah. Now, so you get Sun, and I think it was the greatest thing that ever happened, and thank you, because what you did was you went into the vaults and you released masters that had never before seen the light of day.
There was quite a few of them there, and a lot of them were great recordings that, for some reason or another, Sam would probably get angry with an act and just say, I'm not going to release that record, you know. And, but when we first got involved in releasing the records, it was right at the beginning of Johnny Cash's replacement show that he had on in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the end of that year, we had like five Johnny Cash albums in the charts.
Oh, yeah. And they were great. I think that was his best stuff. You know, I mean, just classic Sun stuff.
Seems that the people today still think that because the movie is proving that.
Oh, you betcha. Like Ballad of a Teenage Queen and Guess Things Happen That Way. And
right. So
many that just, of course, I Walk the Line, which we were playing earlier, just have a feel to it that, a soul to it, which was later missing, I think is probably the best way to say it. But not only Johnny, you came up with some Charlie Rich classics that, frankly, I used to handle Charlie's promotion. In fact, you don't remember it, but that's the time I saw you in your office when I was with Cy Rosenberg. And I promoted Charlie's stuff to radio stations, and I had never heard the likes of things like That's How Much I Love You. Just great stuff.
Yeah, there was a lot of great stuff that were just laying in the vaults, just waiting to be released.
And it really makes you wonder why this thing hadn't come out at the time. But like you say, maybe it was personal reasons or just non-interest.
Well, you know, I think it was a lack of concentration on the recording industry and Sam Moore being interested in Holiday Inns and his radio stations than he was in the music.
Now, when you were going through the vaults, obviously, at first, I'm sure you came across the stuff you'd expect to come across, but what are the jewels that stand out that you had flat out not even known were there?
The Million Dollar Quartet is probably the front runner of that group. This is a jam session of Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins. Mm. And it's about, there was about 2 hours of it, and originally, it surfaced back in the, I guess, the early 70s on bootleg albums in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to release it ourselves, and then RCA sued me. And me and RCA fought for 15 years in court.
What was the upshot of that, finally?
Well, it was finally... they finally agreed that they could only own a quarter of it, and we owned three quarters of it.
Now, you know, it's fascinating that they would spend all that, granted it's in-house legal and all, but all that time and energy and money to pursue that. I assume that you got under somebody's skin at RCA.
Probably.
Do you have any idea who that might have been?
What you have to realize, during that time, BMG had bought RCA, and the regime changed. And when we were able to put the whole thing together and make a deal with them to let them release the recording. And it, you know, it came out into the marketplace. It sold quite well. And then for some reason or another, RCA took it off the market. Mm-hmm. And this year is the 50th anniversary of that recording, and we're trying to get them to re-release it now, and whether they will or not, I don't really know.
Now, if they don't, would you have the right to do so?
No.
Oh, that's a shame, because I know you do a great job.
Not without their permission.
Right. And who knows, being it's BMG, you might be able to get that now because the emotion's gone.
Well, not only that, it's like they've got a lot of young people there that realize the value of some of the older product, because Elvis has already proved that, you know, over and over again in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years with all the recordings that he sold.
Oh, of course. Now, going back to you getting out of Korea and all that, winding up, and I know you were Texas-born, how'd you wind up with a Louisiana hayride?
Well, that was, I was living in Shreveport, and my first wife wanted to be a singer, and that's how I got involved in it.
And you made her one.
Right.
Absolutely, Margie Singleton.
Right.
And it was only recently that, because I know, didn't she marry like Leon Ashley after
right.
that? Right. Right, and I remembered that, but I hadn't, you know, I never put it together that, yeah, the names are the same, probably the people are. But nonetheless, so the Louisiana Hayride back in the day, and what an interesting group of people that must have been, KWKH and Silman Franks and everybody else. At the time, you were promoting also for Mercury?
Well, I was an industrial engineer for Remington Rand.
Oh, my God.
And got involved in promotion accidentally because of her, I guess. And I was looking for something. You know, at Remington Rand, you got to wait till somebody dies before you go anyplace. Right. So, you know, I was looking for something that had more opportunity, and that's how I got involved in the music business.
That's fascinating. So there's a debt of gratitude there, that's for sure. So when you were doing the local Mercury stuff, at first was that just as a promoter of their product?
Well, I was just promoting their records in, you know, basically in Louisiana to begin with, and then later on they gave me the whole South, and then after that I got involved in A&R.
Right, and that's some of your really, really splendid stuff. And I believe you also hired Jerry Ross.
Yeah, Jerry Ross from Philadelphia,
right.
And also Jerry Kennedy.
Right.
You know, Jerry Kennedy was like my right-hand man. He was my ears in the studio, I guess, because I'm not really a musician, and I couldn't tell if the artist was flat or sharp or crooked.
Oh, isn't that an admission? I would have never thought that.
But, you know, some of the musicians say that I've got street ears, that I listen to it like the people that buy the records do. And so that's what I would look for, songs that I thought that people would buy. But, you know, the main thing, you know, in promoting records, as you probably know, is like the first thing you do, you make a record for radio to play, and then second for people to buy.
Oh, of course. Of course, because in this country, they're absolutely locked. Without airplay, it's impossible.
Right.
Now, initially, I know there were some of the country acts, George Jones, and many of the people who were on Mercury, but you quickly wound up getting into R&B and soul, the likes of Clyde McFadder and such. Now, did you have a personal liking for that?
I've always told everybody, Raleigh, that I like anything that sells. If it don't sell, I don't like it.
Oh,
but I love R&B music, and I love classical music, and the pop music is, you know, I've recorded people like, you know, Johnny Mathis and some of the big pop stars, Anonymous Scurry in Europe. And
yeah, and Joe Dowell here teaching him his German accent.
Right, and Wooden Heart.
Yes.
Little Red Rented Rowboat.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, probably, you know, some of the best recordings I made were with people like Johnny Holiday in France.
Oh, yeah, a legend.
Yeah, Holiday is like still a superstar today, you know, off of the things that we started with back in the 60s.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, and of course, this is the country that also reveres Jerry Lewis, but that not said, Johnny Holiday is huge to this day.
Right.
Now, Jerry Lee signed with Smash, and I assume Smash, of course, is a subsidiary of Mercury. I assume that was in part your doing.
Yeah, I signed Jerry Lee to Smash and did two or three albums with him. Probably the best album I ever did was called The Greatest Live Show on Earth. And it was a live album we cut partially in Montgomery, Alabama, and the other part in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, man. Now, he had to be a trip to work with.
Jerry Lee never gave me that many problems. He gave a lot of people problems. It's like when we go in the studio and we'd start to do playbacks. As I'd turned up so loud, I'd run all of his kinfolks out of the control room.
Yeah. So he'd met his match with you, that's for sure.
Right.
Well, that's neat. And interestingly that Charlie Rich really was weaving in and out of your career, because in the Smash days, I mean, I don't think he ever did a better record than Mohair Sam. Just a classic.
I signed him and gave him to Jerry Kennedy to produce. Jerry produced those records.
And just wonderful, wonderful stuff. Like I say, I don't think you beat Mohair Sam.
No, it was a great record.
And then, of course, the stuff you released later on Sun was classic. And, of course, he was also on RCA in addition to Epic and everything else. So it goes round. When did you move to Nashville?
When did I?
Yeah.
On March the 1st, Jerry Kennedy was telling me today, will be 40 years.
Wow, all right. So March the 1st to 66, and it's never been
no,
the same.
No, wait a minute. No, no? I'm sorry, 45 years.
Okay, 61.
Right.
All right, hang on a minute. We got Shelby Singleton with us. And as I was saying earlier, the hardest thing I had to do with this was try to boil down what I wanted to talk about, because I could go on for hours. And we'll go on for at least another half hour.
It's the Raleigh James Show.
Tell you about Ahab, the Arab, the sheikh of the burning sands. He had emeralds and rubies just a dripping off of him, and a ring on every finger of his hand. He wore a big old turban wrapped around his head and a scimitar by his side. And every evening about midnight, he'd jump on his camel named Clyde and ride silently through the night to the sultan's tent, where he would secretly meet up with Fatima of the Seven Veils, the swingin'est number one dancer in the sultan's whole harem. Cause like him and her had a thing going, you know, and they'd been carrying on for some time now behind the sultan's back. And you could hear him talk to his camel as he rode out across the dunes. His voice would cut through the still night desert air, and he'd say, oh, yo, which is Aramaic for whoa, babies. And Clyde say,
blanketing North America with the widest variety of absolutely useless knowledge. It's the Raleigh James Show. Call Raleigh at 888.
No, don't do that. Don't call me. I'm hogging Shelby Singleton. Forget it. You can't have him. All right. Well, if this isn't politically incorrect, I give up.
Fingers and bells on her toes and a bone in her nose. Ho, ho.
Indeed. And that is the handiwork of Shelby Singleton. And we'll talk a little more about the Mercury period. I want to know about Clyde McFadder, and there's an interesting story about Lover Please, but obviously Roger Miller and Bobby Hebb and everybody else, but SSS, Johnny Adams, some of my all-time faves. So plenty of things to cover. In fact, this is also the guy who, as far as I can tell, introduced David Allan Coe to many of us. Don't hold a grudge.
After living in three dozen cities, she's finally run out of them. It's the Raleigh James Show.
Well, there it is. Of all the records that Shelby Singleton has ever been involved with, other than Mohair Sam, this is my favorite. So, Shelby, did you...
Just say Reconsider Me.
You know, it's I Won't Cry.
Yeah. That's a great record.
Yeah, absolutely. Now,
you know, Johnny Adams was probably one of the best R&B singers that I ever recorded.
Good. Now, you first worked with him at Mercury, didn't you?
No.
But he was on the label. No, wait, he was on Liberty.
No, I don't think he was.
Who was he?
He was on one of Joe Beneshek's labels down in New Orleans.
Like Minute or one of those.
Yeah.
All right, and then the I Won't Cry, the version you put on SSS, was that a remake?
No, that originally was on a label called Watch,
right,
which belonged to Henry Hildebrand, who was the distributor in New Orleans.
Okay. All right, and just a terrific record and a terrific artist. And, of course, this so very different than your country roots, although Nashville, a lot of people don't realize, has as much soul and R&B influence thanks to WLAC and stuff. But how did you come to hook up with Johnny?
Through my friend Henry Hildebrand that owned All South Record Distributors down in New Orleans.
Sure, all right. And a great, great act. But I guess it was on Triple S that you had Peggy Scott and JoJo Benson, and you came to make what is arguably the first soul music video. How did that come about?
Well, it was probably one of the first videos that was ever made of any kind.
Yeah.
It was on a song called Soul Shake.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this was, when we started making these, we made several of them on different people, but they were made for promotion. Instead of sending the act and 19 hangers-on with them to Europe to promote records, we would send the videos. And the videos would actually be aired on the television stations in Holland and Germany and France and Italy and in those markets. Is you know, when I got involved in my own record company, I had a lot of experience in the foreign markets.
Mm-hmm.
And by recording, you know, people like Dusty Springfield and the Springfields in England, and, you know, Johnny Holiday in France, Anonymous Scurry in Greece, and Freddie Quinn in Germany, and these people, and I knew the distribution and the promotion in those markets.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having, you know, 12 or 1500 radio stations that play records like we do in the United States, they've only got two or three that do.
Right, usually owned by the state.
Right, and it's usually owned by whatever country you're
right.
in. And on television, they would maybe have one pop music show a month instead of having it, you know, on mm-hmm. 19 cable stations
right.
at one time.
Right.
So if you could get a record on that pop show or a video onto it without having to send the actor and go to all of the expense and send their band with them and all the caretakers that they need when they go, well, it was a lot cheaper to go ahead and make the videos and send them over there to get the records played.
Now, this is a gold mine, because I'm starting to think you've got more than Soul Shake. What else did you do?
We did a great documentary about 15 minutes on David Allan Coe.
We're going to get to him.
And then we did on Jeannie C. Riley on the follow-up to Harper Valley, we did The Girl Most Likely.
To wind up in an jam.
Right, and, you know, several things like that. Those were the ones that we were actually playing with during that time.
Now, you also recorded some Wilbert Harrison on SSS, right?
That was something that Huey Moe did.
Okay.
And you just put out. To put it out for him.
All right. How about Clifford Curry?
Clifford Curry, yeah, was something we did here. She Shot a Hole in My Soul.
What a great record. So, yes. Now, got plenty of questions about David Allan Coe, as I was saying. And of course, his legend is probably greater than he is. How did you wind up getting to know him?
I read a story in the newspaper one day about this guy that was living in an ambulance down, or a hearse down on Broadway here in Nashville, and I sent somebody in my office down there to find him. And they brought him out, and here's this little skinny guy, must weigh 110 pounds and, you know, 6'3" tall. And I asked him what he's saying, and he says, well, I sing all kinds of stuff. And I said, well, let me hear something. And so he started singing me all those prison songs that he'd written in prison, you know, like Old Warden and Cell Block Number 9 and those type of things. And that was part of that was the first album I did with him called Penitentiary Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And as David developed, I guess CBS wanted him worse than I did, and I got to the point where I couldn't afford, you know, every day of feeding him money and feeding him, taking care of him like he was my child or something.
Yes.
So I sold his contract to CBS.
Yeah.
And David and I have remained good friends, you know, since then. I mean, he still, when he comes to Nashville, he comes by the office and always comes in to say hello. And sometimes he'll drive in with three or four trailer trucks and have each one of the trailer trucks has got a motorcycle in the back of it, and that's all it's in them. That's part of his show.
Oh, well, sure. And part of his legend when he first came to Nashville and was talking about how he killed people in prison, I understand that the prison didn't know about that.
Well, you know, as I always tell everybody that, most of David's stories are BS, but it's good for promotion.
Oh, sure it is. You and you're great at that. Now, jumping around here, Clyde McFadder and Lover Please was always a fascinating record to me, including Billy Swan wrote that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like it was on Bill Black's label, and I called Bill Black and tried to buy the master from him, and he didn't want to sell it. He said he was going to carry it on himself. Okay. He was going to get Joe Coogie with High Records to distribute it.
Okay.
And I told him, I said, you know, if you don't sell it to me, I'm going to cover you on it. He says, you won't cover me. I said, yes, I will, too. I said, I'll go in tomorrow night and cut it with Clyde McFadder. And Clyde didn't want to cut it. And so we got into an argument, and I finally made a deal with Clyde. I said, okay, you cut this one for me, and you can cut any other songs that you want to on the session. So that's the way it was. And let's see, the arranger on that was Stan Applebaum.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan wrote a great string parts in it, and he wrote a fantastic sax solo for King Curtis.
Sure.
And I remember WABC in New York wouldn't play it because they thought the sax solo was too dirty, so I cut the solo out of it and made them play it.
Oh, God. Man, oh, man, talk about
But the backwards. String players are all the ones doing the hand clapping on the record rather than the strings. I took the strings out.
Uh-huh. It's a killer production and a wonderful song, and arguably his best-known song as far as surviving to this day. But
right.
Do you remember what was it that he was wanting to cut?
Oh, I don't know.
Never
I don't
was a
really
hit.
Remember. That's yeah. been too long ago.
Yeah, never was a hit, in other words.
No.
So, yeah. Now, Bobby Hebb was an interesting story when you were still with Mercury because, you know, here he was a Nashville guy, and I figured, well, that's going to be cut in Nashville, and it was cut in New York?
Yeah, I cut it in the Mercury studio in New York, a little demo studio we'd built there, and Jerry Ross produced that record.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, it was funny. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. But anyway, somebody came up there, and the B-side of that record, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
is the side that Mercury was working on.
Isn't that always the way?
And somebody in Detroit, I believe it was, started playing the sunny side.
Mm-hmm.
And it started getting calls at the record shops there, and that's whenever I got everybody and turned it over and go after the other side of it.
Well, that was the beauty of 45s. You could
oh,
do
yeah.
it. And, you know, that was still a little before them pressing the same song on both sides of it. But, yeah, the flip side of Sonny was Bread. I remember this record.
Yeah, and, it was.
And,
right.
it, and it was yeah, it was on Phillips and just pretty a dreadful song. And if somebody hadn't flipped that, that would have been. And Sonny was written by Bobby Hebb, too, right?
Right. And Bobby's moved back to Nashville. He used to live up in around Boston someplace,
uh-huh.
but he's back here now.
Now, Roger Miller, that must have been a fascinating, you know, relationship.
Well, you know, Roger was very talented. I'd known Roger for many years before I ever signed him, but he had written a lot of hits for other artists, like, let's see, what did he write? Invitation to Your Party that Ray Price had
mm-hmm.
and several other things, but Roger was originally a bellhop at one of the hotels here in Nashville.
Oh, that's great. Do you remember which one?
Yeah, the Andrew Jackson.
Oh, of course. Well, that's convenient.
It's not in existence
right,
anymore.
No.
It's been tore down. But Roger used to come to New York whenever I was in New York, and he'd always come by my office, and he'd want me to go with him over to... It was called, I don't remember what it was called then. It was Jack Parr, was it The Tonight Show?
Yeah,
then?
The Tonight Show, sure, with Jack Parr, of course.
Yeah, but he'd go over and do that show.
Uh-huh.
And he always wanted me to go with him, so I'd go with him. And he was on RCA at that time. And he had that record, In the Summertime When the Trees and Leaves Are Green, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I told him, I said, Roger, I said, why don't you get off of RCA and come on over and we'll make some hits. He says, okay, I will. So about two or three months later, I ran into him down in Printer's Alley one night. I was down there having dinner with a group of people from Mercury, and Roger was sitting over at another table, and I said to Irving Green, who was the head of Mercury, I said, you know, we ought to sign Roger. I said, you know, I think he can he could probably make some hits. He said, well, I thought he was on RCA. I said, well, let me go talk to him. Mm-hmm. I went over and talked to him. He said, no, I just got dropped. So I'm off of RCA now. I said, okay, well, let's make some hits. Okay, we made a deal that night.
Wow, and your first record was like number one for 2 months. Dang me.
Yeah, but, you know, Roger got mad at me. He said if I'd waited 2 weeks to release that record, he'd probably saved him several $1 million because he was in the middle of a divorce and it wasn't final until 2 weeks after the record came.
Oh, this poor guy. And I know he...
But Jerry Kennedy produced all those records on Roger, and, you know, like he did, like I was telling you, he did with Charlie Rich.
Right, right. And just wonderful stuff on Roger. Clever, well-produced. Kansas City Star is just a classic to this day in my mind.
Well, I think the first records that Jerry produced on him were just straight-ahead country songs. And whenever I got him in and listened to him, as I called Jerry back up and I said, Jerry, you know, Roger needs to cut all them silly songs he's always singing us.
Yeah.
And Jerry says, well, you know, ain't none of them songs finished. I said, well, tell him to finish the things then. So, you know, Dang Me is probably like a, you know, a double, the timing on it is probably 1 minute so, and then we do had to double the time to make it,
yes,
it what it is.
They
know.
Were short, you're right, but my God, King of the Road became his signature song.
Oh, yeah, that was a great recording.
Yeah, and then they opened the hotel in Nashville, and it was just a riot. But so many, many things, and, you know, you were saying you weren't sure you could, you know, recognize a note or carry a tune, but the reality is just advice like do the silly stuff made the difference between an obscure bellhop and a real hit artist.
That's true. That's true.
You know, so just knowing that.
But he had all that underlying talent, you know, like a lot of people do, and you just had to find a way to force it out of him.
Well, yeah, he also had that underlying depression, so you had to know him to be able to get that out of him. You know, that was another case of finessing somebody to get him to do that. So that couldn't have been too easy. But now here you are, my God, over 40 years later, and suddenly a Johnny Cash movie becomes just sweeps the country, just huge. Did that surprise you?
No, not really. And I think probably what won't surprise anybody else is if they do the Sun story, and you got Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and Roy Orbison and Elvis all in the same movie.
Will they?
It's something that's been talked about. If somebody comes up with the right funding, with the right producer, that to do it right, you know, like the Cash movie, I think was done exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, it just, you can't just go and say, I'm going to do a movie and, and, you know, just take and piece it together and everything. There has to be a lot of thought put into it.
Oh, sure, and there's got to also be the people there who are able to clear the clips that you need, because very often you see productions that just miss it because they tried the workaround on not getting the pieces
they wanted.
Well,
they try to save money to lose money,
right,
is what they do.
Right, and it just doesn't work. Whatever it takes to get the originals is just needed. But it was a wonderful production, and, of course, I don't think it probably would have been, if not there at all, certainly what it was, without you mining the Sun Vault. So thank you for that.
Well, we've been working on that for many years now, since 1969 when I first bought Sun.
Well, and I'm thrilled that it's all come out, and I know for a while some of us out on Charlie and some of the British labels, but it's just a wonderful addition, which, frankly, if you hadn't bought it, those records might have never seen the light of day, so we all owe you a debt of
gratitude. Probably, too. They'd probably still be laying over there in the vault with the tapes, you know, the emulsion coming off.
Right, the oxidation happening as we speak, yes, indeed. And hard to believe, but there goes an hour, and the hardest thing I had, Shelby, with you was trying to call down into a few minutes what I wanted to talk about. We could do this all night, so I hope we'll do it again.
We can do it again anytime.
All right, it's wonderful to talk to you, and thanks again, and keep it up.
Okay.
All right, good, Shelby,
good to
thanks.
Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Night.
All right, so Shelby Singleton, absolutely a legend, truly. And we could have gone on for hours and hours. We didn't even talk about Bruce Chanel, which I played at the top of the hour in that little mix. Or the Brooke Benton. He did produce Bull Weevil, Shelby did. And so many. Yeah, I didn't even get a chance to play some of the other Jeannie C. Riley stuff. All right, so Margie Singleton didn't do Harper Valley PTA. And see, I'd always heard that she did. And, of course, Margie, thanks to Shelby, quite the artist in her own right. So that was a lot of fun. We'll do it again. Now, speaking of fun, we'll play trivia for the next 2 hours. And I must confess that I was actually thinking more about Shelby than trivia, so I got to find the questions.